From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm David Windsor. First this morning, we speak with Dr. Arik Prather, a world-renowned sleep scientist and expert clinician who has cracked the code to help even the most restless sleepers get a good night's rest. Then, Dr. Kathleen Nadeau, the founder, clinical director of the largest private ADHD special clinic in the U.S. She joins us now to discuss her new book, Still Distracted After All These Years, Help Support for the Older Adults with ADHD. Stay tuned with us. We'll be right back after these underwriters.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Much has been written about how to help children with ADHD, but next to nothing on ADHD in older adults, which can often mirror, imitate, or exacerbate the normal brain changes associated with aging. Our next guest, Dr. Kathleen Nadeau, is the founder and clinical director of the largest private ADHD specialty clinic in the U.S. She's practiced psychology since the early 70s and is the author and co-author of many books on ADHD, including the best-selling ADD Friendly Ways to Organize Your Life. She joins us now to discuss her new book, Still Distracted After All These Years, Help and Support for Older Adults with ADHD. Dr. Kathleen Nadeau, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really excited to have an opportunity to talk about this.
Well, it is so important. And I think so many adults, you know, wonder if they have ADD or ADHD because it wasn't really starting to be diagnosed, as far as I know, until like the late 80s, maybe early 90s, you know, widely diagnosed. Is that true?
That is true. Well, there's a long, difficult history about this thing we call ADHD right now. And I think we're on the way to finding a different name for it because it's so misunderstood. But we used to talk about hyperactivity. Everybody's heard about hyperactive kids. And when I was in grad school, I, you know, cringed to think I was taught that it only affects boys and that you outgrow it when you're 12 or 13. And neither one of those things is true. And we've just come so far in the past decades of understanding what this disorder is. And what we now know is it's something we're born with. It runs in families, and it's something that impacts us throughout our entire lives. And the reason I wrote Still Distracted After All These Years is that there's absolutely nothing for older adults. And the sad fact of the matter is neurologists, psychiatrists, clinical psychologists are not trained in recognizing ADHD in older adults. In fact, some of them misdiagnose ADHD symptoms as the beginnings of dementia.
And yes, things like dementia and anxiety and depression and even these other symptoms that seem to widely plague adults can be sort of tied into this. Could you help us out with definitions? I mean, why do we still call it ADHD when most adults don't have that hyperactive component?
Well, that is a title developed by a committee. You know, it's sort of like everybody jokes that a camel is an animal created by a committee because it's so awkward and lumpy. And they recognized several decades ago that people with inattentive ADHD really have the same disorder as people that were hyperactive. In fact, we know that people rarely remain hyperactive. Obviously, that's not the core symptom. But the researchers who had done all this research on hyperactivity wanted to keep that name in there. So it makes absolutely no logical sense. But we've got attention deficit hyperactivity disorder without hyperactivity. Does that make any sense? And I think the general public has really started calling it ADD if there's no hyperactivity, which makes a lot more sense to me.
I was diagnosed with ADHD at a young age, and it's carried with me, obviously, my whole life. And you mentioned that you're born with it, but can they develop this disorder throughout their life, or is it something that it just happens from a young age, no matter what?
That's a great question with sort of a complicated answer. You are born with these traits, but they may not emerge until much later in life. Doesn't mean it hasn't been there. ADHD emerges when we can no longer manage the daily demands of life. And sometimes if people grow up in a very stable household, if they go to a school with small classes and attentive teachers, if they have an above average IQ, if they're female, it's interesting, but females work much, much harder to mask their ADHD as kids. They don't want to be in trouble with the teacher, and so they hide it. One doctor I talked to said that girls fake it till they make it. They're trying so hard to hide their ADHD. So it's always there. We're born with it. But depending on lots of different factors, it may not show up until we're adult. It can show up in college. I've worked with lots of people that did pretty darn well in high school when they were still living at home, if they had parents that were kind of providing a lot of support and structure, and then went off to college and everything fell apart. In fact, there's this phenomenon we talk about called crash and burn freshman year with students with ADHD that go off to college. And as everybody knows, college is filled with temptations and distractions, and it takes a lot of focus and self-discipline to get yourself to class when nobody is taking roll, to get your assignments done when there's nobody reminding you to go to bed or that your paper is due on Friday. And so sadly, statistically, we know that only about 1 in 20 college students with ADHD graduates from college within 4 years. It's a rare event because college is such a tough change. All the structure and support disappears. And one of the things I want to talk about regarding older adults is we're dealing with some of the very same things when we go into our retirement years that teenagers are when they leave home. We lose all the structure and support of our working years. We lose our social connections, our daily structure, a place to go, a time to be there. We lose often a sense of purpose. And I see older adults who might have been functioning pretty darn well during their working years kind of fall apart when they go into retirement, especially if they're socially isolated.
So some of the possible signs we talk about of adult ADHD is forgetting to pay your bills, living in a disorganized environment, struggling with depression, anxiety, procrastinating, conflicts with those close to you. And this pretty much sums up at least one individual in every part of my circle. And so by that facet, does everyone essentially have a form of ADHD?
Oh, absolutely not. But it's interesting that you say, excuse me, that almost everyone you know acts like that, because I think in some ways it's a birds of a feather flock together phenomenon, that people with ADHD are often attracted to other people with ADHD. And of course, ADHD runs in families. More than half of my personal family is impacted by ADHD. So I've lived it in many different iterations over the years. But no, what I think what you're talking about is that there's no single symptom of ADHD that most people haven't experienced at one time or another. And that's why I think sometimes it gets diagnosed, oh, I lose my keys sometimes. Oh, I forget appointments sometimes. So, I mean, that's just normal. And it really dismisses what is a significant issue for people with real ADHD. Yes, everybody does those things some of the time, but it's sort of like denying that there's such a thing as anxiety disorder because everybody's felt anxious every once in a while. It trivializes it. And just like anxiety can be crippling, ADHD in older adults can be really crippling. It can lead to dangerous social isolation, living in a chaotic home environment where there's no bedtime, there's no get up time, there's no healthy diet. I've worked with adults that basically live on cheese and crackers and snacking out of the refrigerator because they just can't organize themselves to go to the grocery store and cook healthy meals. Mm. It really impacts us as we get older.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Kathleen Nadeau. She is the founder and director of an ADHD specialty clinic, the largest one in the U.S., and we're speaking to her about her new book, Still Distracted After All These Years, It's Help and Support for Older Adults with ADHD. So we've talked about genetic ADHD, and that's, you know, sort of how, well, I guess I'm trying to ascertain the difference between genetic ADHD and environmental ADHD. How do you know? Because as you say, we all feel to a certain degree that we have ADHD, but how do you know if it's really the genetic one or just, you know, you've developed this inability to pay attention and things?
Well, that's a very good question. And I'm glad you asked it because I think a lot of people dismiss genuine ADHD as, oh, you know, that's just a sign of the times. That's the way everybody is. And you're very right that we are, many of us are leading lifestyles that will cause us to behave in a disorganized, distracted way. We're sort of inviting the world into our brains. I mean, the flood of social media posts, the flood of news posts, of emails, we receive more communications in the course of a year these days than two generations ago people received in a lifetime in terms of phone calls and letters. That used to be how we communicated. So the more fast-paced and interrupting and distracting our life is, of course, our brains don't function very well under those circumstances. But I'll tell you that people that don't have ADHD will say, I used to be very organized. It's just since I got this super high stress job, or it's just since my daughter got a divorce and moved into my house with a hyperactive grandchild. In other words, that my stress level has gone way up and suddenly I'm distracted and scattered. That's not ADHD, but it is ADHD if you have experienced these issues really over the course of years and decades, and understanding that real, what you're calling genetic ADHD, waxes and wanes in that our ADHD is a lot worse when we've had a bad night's sleep. It's a lot worse when we're under high stress. And so those are exactly the things we need to understand in order to better manage it, that just one night of bad sleep can sort of give us a double dose of ADHD. And many older adults that I talk to say, my brain is just spinning all the time. I may not look hyperactive on the outside, but my brain is hyperactive. And it's so hard for me to calm down, settle down, and fall asleep at night.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Still Distracted After All These Years, how do you help the reader find out or maybe self-diagnose?
Well, there's a questionnaire that I created after all my many years working with adults that people can use just as a screener. It's not a diagnostic tool. If you want a real diagnosis, you need to go to a professional. You need to go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And more psychologists than psychiatrists are trained in understanding and diagnosing ADHD. But you don't need a formal diagnosis to do the many, many things in my book that I recommend to help manage ADHD as an older adult. I'd like to tell you a story because it really opened my eyes and made me, you know, even more intensely focused on finishing my book. And that is, at the beginning of COVID at my clinic, we offered a whole range of free online support groups for parents of kids with ADHD, for teenagers, et cetera. And I ran a support group for older adults with ADHD. And that group was the most successful group of any of the groups we offered at my clinic. It was so clear that this was one of the few groups in the country focused on the needs of older adults. And we had people from all across the country joining the group because it was on Zoom. And that group, I ran that group for a year. The participants said, this is the highlight of my week. It's the first time I've ever been in a room of people that accepted me, that understood me, that supported me. And that group continues to meet without me. They became so important to one another that they've been meeting on their own for over a year now, still meeting on Zoom. And one of my greatest hopes is that I can inspire some of the national ADD organizations to provide online support groups for older adults. There's just almost nothing out there to support them. And the whole reason for Still Distracted after all these years is to launch that awareness.
What about with the different generations? Because with these older adults, you know, the seniors, they're, this is a newer thing for them. And, you know, I'm a millennial. And so when I was diagnosed at a young age, obviously the science and everything was better by the time I was a child. And then so for the Gen X and the boomers, are there different types of diagnosis or symptoms that these people are experiencing because it's been such a foreign thing to them through their years?
Well, older adults are certainly much, much less likely to be hyperactive, although they tell me that I feel hyperactive inside. In other words, I don't feel calm. I've got so many reactions and thoughts going through my head, I don't feel calm. But the symptoms are the same throughout life, aside from that hyperactive impulsivity that we see in some kids, teenagers, young adults. But I think one of the things that's so important in getting the diagnosis is to bring a family member with you who has known you for many years. I think ADHD symptoms in an older adult can be misdiagnosed as early signs of dementia. And if you have a son or a daughter or a sibling that's known you forever said, oh no, she's been like this forever. She's always been forgetful, disorganized, tends to interrupt people in conversations, kind of scattered. Then that kind of nails the ADHD diagnosis. And sadly, when people go to memory clinics, people with ADHD are forgetful. They forget what they intended to do in half an hour. They forget the details of what somebody might have told them this morning. So when they get older, that forgetfulness may begin to feel scary. And am I beginning to develop Alzheimer's? They go to a memory clinic, and a study was done inquiring, do memory clinics testing the memory of older adults even consider adult ADHD? And very few of them did. And so I have a story that I write about in my book of a woman in South Florida being misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's because they didn't ask the all-important questions of, no, I've been this way forever. I mean, it couldn't be Alzheimer's because if you talked to me when I was 40, I was scattered and forgetful and distractible. So it's so important that we inform the memory clinics that this is something you should screen for. What people don't know is that among adult psychiatric disorders, ADHD is among the top four most common adult psychiatric disorders, and yet we're not training adult psychiatrists and neurologists about adult ADHD. The other three, that the top four, anxiety, depression, bipolar, and ADHD. Well, they all know about anxiety, depression, and bipolar. And so very often that's the only thing that people pay attention to. Ah, you have an anxiety disorder. Yes, I do, but I also have ADHD. And nobody's looking at that. And so nobody's treating it.
It's kind of scary how much this could be neglected and misdiagnosed. What about medications? When I was growing up, there was the typical name brand medications that were given to kids that were diagnosed with ADHD. Are those same types of medication being diagnosed or prescribe to these patients? One, and two, are there other alternatives like exercise and stuff that can help combat this?
That's a very good question. Number one, yes, adults of any age respond well to exactly the same stimulant medications that work with kids, teenagers. We have expanded the range of stimulant medications so that some are more effective than others. They have different delivery systems, but they're all essentially the same, and they work with adults as well as children. The only caveat is that as an older adult, you may have some heart concerns, and therefore you really need to be cleared by your primary care physician or your cardiologist before trying stimulants. But the great majority of older adults can tolerate and really benefit from stimulant medication. But the second part of your question is just as important. And that is, these are not magic pills. You can't take a pill and suddenly lead a satisfying, focused, socially connected, well-organized life. They're not magic pills. What they do is put your brain in a situation where you can develop habits and patterns that will help you function better in your daily life. There are lots of things that we can do and should do to have optimal cognitive functioning as older adults. And I write about that in Still Distracted after all these years. There's a whole chapter on brain healthy daily habits, which have to do with stress management, daily exercise, exposure to nature. A lot of people don't realize, but there is a big body of research showing that our ADHD symptoms lessen if we're outside in nature. It has a calming influence. Sleep, social connections, and diet. Many people with ADHD eat an unhealthy diet because it's just easier. Planning and preparing meals requires a lot of effort. And so lots of us with and without ADHD resort to junk food, fast food, carry out, and our brains and our bodies pay a big toll for that over the years. I mean, we are starting a program at my clinic called Stop Losing the Food Fight, which is trying to teach people to get out of these very disordered eating patterns. And there's an alarming statistic. Dr. Russell Barkley, very preeminent ADHD researcher, did a big study and announced about 3 years ago that statistically, people with ADHD who don't have brain healthy daily habits, the ones I just outlined, tend to live about 10 years less than adults without ADHD. We pay a big price for those unhealthy daily habits, which are, of course, the easiest ones, the go-to ones. It's much easier not to exercise. It's much easier to eat fast food or stick a frozen meal in the microwave. So I think older adults need a lot of help and support in gradually changing their daily habits. The good news is that research has shown we can actually reverse cognitive decline in our later years if we change our daily habits. Mm.
I had interviewed a young woman who was an Olympian, a several-time Olympian on the U.S. cross-country team, and she had said that when she was in elementary school, she had, you know, I don't know if it was diagnosed or not, but she obviously had this issue with ADHD, and she had this beloved teacher who really opened her up to the world of sport, who would say when she couldn't sit still, it would send her out and tell her to run a couple times around the track, and then she could come back to class. And she said that sort of that alerted her to this thing that she realized that she had to get both A, outside, and B, move her body to feel that ability to calm. And I think you make such a good point. You know, for anyone who has what we consider ADHD symptoms, maybe it's not genetic, maybe it is environmental. And certainly your book is going to help those of us who may think we do. And the question I have is, you know, reading a book like yours, Still Distracted After All These Years, would that be the direction to go if you are someone who feels like maybe they don't need the diagnostic test yet, they'd rather sort of take these tips that you're giving and see if it helps? And
absolutely. And that's why we intentionally put as the subtitle for those with and without a diagnosis, because you don't need a formal diagnosis to better understand yourself and to better understand how you can lead a more functional, more satisfying life. Of course, you can do that and should do that. So I encourage people that are never going to seek a diagnosis. Maybe they say, why should I get diagnosed? I don't want medication. It's still important to understand what's going on and what you can do to change.
Dr. Kathleen Nadeau is our guest. Her book is Still Distracted After All These Years. It's help and support for older adults with ADHD. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been great.
All right. Once again, that was Dr. Kathleen Nadeau speaking about her new book, Still Distracted After All These Years, help support for older adults with ADHD. I'm David Windsor. This is The Mountain Life. Stay tuned with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Dr. Eric Prather is a world-renowned sleep scientist and an expert clinician who has cracked the code to help even the most restless of sleepers get a good night's rest. So what if, over the course of 7 days, you could be taught how to get out of your own way so that your body can do effortlessly what it was built to do, sleep well? What a concept. Dr. Prather's new book is The Sleep Prescription, 7 Days to Unlocking Your Best Rest. He joins us now. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Eric.
Well, thank you for having me.
We talk a lot about sleep on this show, and I think in general, sleep is so elusive, especially as you become older. What is the difference about how we could sleep for 12 hours without waking up when we were in our 20s? And as you age, it just gets harder and harder.
Yeah, it certainly does, doesn't it? You know, we know that sleep changes as we age. You know, there's lots of good evidence to suggest that, you know, sleep becomes a little bit shorter as we get older, a little bit more fragmented. And honestly, we don't have a great understanding about why that is, just more that it does happen. I mean, certainly there are changes within the life course that contribute to that, you know, I mean, but it is interesting that it does get a little bit harder as we get older, just like most things, I would say.
Yeah, you can say that again. Well, your book will take us over 7 days and 7 different types of things that we can do to help us sleep. And I'm going to jump around a bit. The one that I'm most excited about is sort of throwing out what all these sleep experts tell us to do about relaxing and, you know, not having screen time or whatever it is. And you say to do really what relaxes you the most. And I'm so happy to hear that you watch or listen to over and over and over episodes of The Office, because my thing is I do that with Madam Secretary.
Isn't it funny? I know. I don't know what it is. I feel like I'm just around here promoting The Office, but absolutely. So, you know, let me say that, you know, one of the concerns about watching those things, right, is blue light exposure, right? And blue light exposure is cotton, you know, a link towards kind of downregulating your melatonin production, which is important for sleep. And that is a real thing. And some people are really sensitive to that. But I also think that people need things to do to wind down. And oftentimes it's really about the content that keeps people up, right? So even if blue light does have an effect, and luckily we can put like filters on our glasses or filters on our screens, but, you know, if you do that and you're binge watching some Netflix series that you couldn't wait to watch, you're still going to stay awake despite, you know, blocking out that blue light. And so the point is really having things that can facilitate relaxation for you, things that you enjoy, kind of this low arousal, slightly positive experience. And I always say, you know, like Madam Secretary or The Office, it's things that you don't need to know how it ends because you already know. right? And so there isn't this kind of pull to keep you engaged. And it's really about the engagement and or the lack thereof that helps facilitate kind of relaxation and falling asleep.
What about once you are asleep? A frequent thing for me is when I've been sleeping a lot and then I wake up and think about the things that I have to do in the coming days. What are the techniques that you would apply once you've been asleep and you wake up feeling stress or anxiety or just things that, you know, thinking about the other things you have to do in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's super, super common. And I mean, I think importantly, one that's really common, right? And it doesn't mean that your sleep is broken. If it happens chronically, the important thing to know is you don't want to be doing that for a long period of time in the bed, right? And this is actually a really hard thing to get people to change. But, what happens if people are kind of constantly thinking and worrying in bed is it actually fractures the relationship with the bed, making it a place where you begin to do that over and over and over because your body thinks that's what it's for. And so you want to remove yourself from the bed, do something quiet until you begin to get sleepy again and then get back in bed. But of things that you can do, I mean, one of the things that, you know, certainly seems to be helpful for people is distraction. So whether that's kind of reading or, listening to music or kind of trying to focus your mind on your breathing. So kind of 4-7-8 breathing seems to be really helpful to kind of both increase the parasympathetic nervous system, but also can kind of focuses your mind because we can only keep so many things in our brain at one time. And so kind of using some of that mental effort in that way can be helpful. Guided imagery is often helpful, kind of walking through kind of a really pleasant experience and trying to notice all the sensations that you might have had in that space. All of those things can help people kind of move away from those kind of negative, kind of worrying thoughts towards something that, you know, allows you to facilitate a better sleep.
So all those negative worrying thoughts are linked to the things that are going on throughout your day. And you mentioned that you're to one of your patients that they don't have a nighttime problem, they have a daytime problem. And so what are the things that we all are doing throughout life and society and our jobs, our families? What are these problems that we're accumulating throughout the day and not even realizing?
Well, So in that instance, this nighttime versus daytime problem was it was clear for that individual and so many out there that, you know, they're often like working, kind of involved in life and then think that they can just kind of shut down and go to sleep. And it's actually certainly not like that, right? We need to be able to transition and we also need to kind of find some level of balance in our day. And so in the book, you know, I talk about, you know, scheduling in micro breaks for yourself so that you can have a space to kind of let off some of that steam that builds up in the stressful environment. And then, you know, it should help you during the night. The same thing is around kind of scheduling in some worry time. So this is something that most people don't do, but actually putting in your schedule a time to sit down and kind of just focus on the worries of your life so that it kind of takes the pressure off of yourself in the middle of the night when they crop up, because you know that you've already scheduled in that time and you have it scheduled for tomorrow so you can get back to sleep. I mean, I think in general, there's a lack of kind of time spent to investing in sleep and ensuring that you kind of set up the environment as something that you know will pay dividends the following day. And so it's a little bit of a shift in the way that we think about our day and that sleep isn't just the thing that you do when everything else on your list is crossed off. It's actually something that you want to make sure you protect because it's going to put you in a better position to be your best self, you know, moving forward.
Yes. Being our best self. And when our sleep is compromised, I mean, there are so many things that can also compromise our health. There are some statistics that you mentioned about if we have chronic insomnia or if we're awake for 3 hours in the middle of the night and we don't end up getting more than especially 6 hours a night of sleep, what can happen to our bodies, our organs, and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've learned a lot over the last decade or so around what happens if people are kind of chronically getting insufficient amounts of sleep. And, you know, when people get insufficient amounts of sleep, say, like, as you mentioned, kind of like less than 6 hours on average, chronically, people are at increased risk for things like cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. There's now evidence suggesting that it's associated with the development of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And so it really underscores the importance of kind of protecting that sleep and kind of doing things that we can do to get it back on track. And so that's the idea around this book, is trying to give people practical tips so that they can allow sleep to happen naturally.
Yes, and naturally is something that you really advocate, and sort of away from the sleep aids. I think you give a statistic about, was it like 1 in 4 of us or take some sort of sleep aid, or maybe I didn't get that right.
I mean, it's absolutely really common, and it's understandable. You know, I mean, when people don't get the sleep they need, it's distressing, and we're always looking for something to help fix the problem in the moment. And in, you know, for many of these sleep aids, kind of they're great for kind of acute problems, right? Like travel, or like you need to be on for the next day. But the challenge is that even though they might not be kind of physiologically addicting, they become almost immediately psychologically addicting, right? I mean, people begin immediately to question whether they're able to sleep without it. And that can be a slippery slope and put people in a position where they're kind of really needing them to sleep. And that's what we want to avoid.
What about the use of like the white noise machines or fans or things like that? Like when my daughter was growing up, she always had to have one of those things, and it became difficult as she got older because you know she couldn't travel to friends' houses and have her sound machine in a room full of kids. And so what about things like those types of instruments that aren't necessarily supplements but tools that people use?
I think that's a great point, and those can be really helpful, right, to make the environment kind of better for someone who's sleeping, right? That kind of like constant kind of white noise can help drown out any of the other sounds that go on in the environment. And so that can be really helpful. But I mean, you're right also that, you know, one of the things that can happen is this dependency on them. And so the question that I always raise to people is like, you know, all of those things are fine, except what happens when you don't have them? And then if it becomes something where, you know, oh, then I can't sleep the entire night, then we might have a problem. We have to kind of come up with other strategies to kind of deal with that moving on. And it's not always easy, but it's certainly something that's addressable, over time, and people will kind of, you know, acclimate to the loss of those things ideally over time, or they'll work out with some kind of way to ensure that they have those things. And that's okay too, because really it's about getting the sleep you need. With sleep aids specifically, you know, there's growing concern about kind of chronic use and what it might do to your brain. And so, you know, that's a good enough reason for me to say like, hey, that's probably not the way you want to go. But some of these other things that might help with the environment, maybe they're not so bad. It's just, you know, you need to plan ahead for it.
What about, I'm sure the big one is always caffeine. And, you know, I get good sleep, but I love my caffeine. I love my coffee. I drink a good amount of coffee in the mornings, and then I might have a pick me up in the afternoon as well. And so at what point throughout the day is this type of stimulant going to affect your sleep? And does it affect different people differently? Because for me, I have friends that I know that can't have a cup of coffee afternoon, or they'll be awake all night, where I know I can have an espresso with dinner and still fall asleep. And so is it different per the individual, or a certain amount of caffeine at a certain time is a no?
Yeah. So it, I mean, it's definitely different by individual, right? So we metabolize caffeine at different rates. And so that helps explain why that happens. Some people are really sensitive to caffeine, of course. And some, it does nothing for them. You know, as a rule, we think about caffeine as having a half-life of 6 hours. So a half-life means like, how much time does it take for half of it to be gone out of your system? And so, you know, I always use the example of, well, if you have a double espresso at 4 p.m., that means at 10 p.m., you still have a single espresso in your body. Now, of course, the metabolizing varies by person, and so maybe the half-life varies in that way. But, you know, it's a good rule of thumb to kind of think about it. And so, you know, we typically say, you know, try to not have more caffeine after lunch. But, you know, some of that depends on like what time you're going to bed. If you're going to bed at 3 a.m, then, you know, maybe a little bit later is okay because you have more time. I think it's just about, you know, ensuring that you make sure you don't put yourself in a position where it does fragment your sleep or, you know, get in the way of you falling asleep. But, you know, that's a good tool to try out and see kind of what works for you. You know, just, you might luck out like you do and have an espresso at dinner.
Absolutely. Lucky you, David. if you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, our guest is Dr. Eric Prather. His book is The Sleep Prescription, 7 Days to Unlocking Your Best Rest. And Eric, this is part of a series. It's a 7-day series on all these, how to kind of correct and make better all these really important elements of our lives. And I think that's interesting. It's the first I've heard of a series, but do you think that in 7 days, it's just enough to scratch the surface of helping us get a better night's rest, or is it just kind of showing us what habits we should develop?
Yeah. So, you know, the principles that are laid out in this book are taken from what we do in our clinic, which is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And so, but you know, when we do that with a patient, it takes like 6 weeks, right? And we work a lot on these things, but you know, no one wanted to read a 6-week book, you know, it would be too long and it'd be monotonous. And so, you know, it's broken down into 7 days. I do think it, you know, and I say this in the last chapter, that this is not the end, it's the beginning. And I like to think of this, you know, 7-day prescription, so to speak, as kind of like a recipe, right? And these are the different ingredients, but you also need to give it time to bake. And so, you know, you start doing these things and then you continue doing them over time, your sleep will improve on average for most people. And that's what I'm really excited about. But yeah, I mean, I think it does take time because not all of them are easy and they do take practice. And so just doing them for one day is going to give you just a little bit of a taste, but it's really about digging in and it's part of the investment for your sleep and for your health.
Absolutely. Kind of going on what David was talking about regarding afternoon caffeine, one of the great things that has received a lot of press around your book is instead of that cup of coffee at 3 p.m., stick your head in a freezer.
Yes. That one has gotten quite a bit of attention. It was definitely trying to capitalize on novelty and what we know about cold exposure. Like when people do polar plunges or in our laboratory, we've done different manipulations where we expose people to cold. And we do see this kind of increase in alertness and increase in their sympathetic nervous system. And so, you know, the thought is kind of like a brisk walk outside, we can kind of get the blood pumping and be able to kind of get over those midday doldrums. But, you know, In that way, also, you can also just go and kind of get your heart rate up and exercise, and that might do the trick as well. But, you know, something to try, see if people like it. And if anything, it's like a fun anecdote in a way that you can try to improve your sleep.
I just got back from this 4-day seminar, and a lot of everything they were teaching us was about shocking your state. And just like you said, whether it's going for that walk, jumping up and down, just screaming out loud, it's changing the mind state to get you out of that. And then obviously nutrition and hydration are big with that. And I'm curious, do you guys recommend any kind of, you know, obviously diet's big, but are there certain things other than water and hydration that you would recommend for people throughout the day, natural type substances to consume?
No, you know, I mean, hydration is certainly a big one, and that, you know, that's undisputed. I mean, I think kind of having a balanced diet, you know, trying to stay away from kind of high sugar, high fat foods, staying away from complex carbohydrates, all those things, you know, seem to kind of be part of the recipe for a healthy diet. You know, I can't say that there's enough like randomized clinical trials with respect to sleep that it will make a huge difference. But I mean, you know, certainly the accruing evidence around just kind of health and well-being suggests that it could only be helpful.
What about insomnia in general? Like, is it something that a lot of people are born with, or they've suffered from it from a long time, or do you develop it over time as your eating habits, your lifestyle, your work, your family? Do all these stresses build into insomnia, or is it something that is ingrained in you from a young age?
You know, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, we think about insomnia as there are kind of things that predispose people. And it does seem to run in families, like there is some genetics to it, but it's, you know, that's certainly not the bulk of it. But, you know, if people have a tendency towards anxiety, a tendency to be sensitive to stressors or happen to be exposed to many more stressors. That seems to be part of what puts people in a place to kind of experience insomnia. You know, certainly if people have had traumas in their life that have led them to be more hypervigilant, you know, sleep is one of those things that honestly is like kind of a little bit scary if you're in a dangerous environment, right? It's not the most adaptive thing to do is to kind of like fall away from the world and be kind of there as potential prey. And so, you know, this hypervigilance, you know, keeps people up. And that also contributes to insomnia. And so in those cases, like those types of things can certainly translate into insomnia later in life. But, you know, even without that, it's also natural when people experience kind of like acute stressors to lose some sleep. And that's fine. But oftentimes people end up kind of making behavioral decisions, you know, not because they are trying to cause insomnia, but it just kind of ends up undermining how sleep works and perpetuates what was kind of an acute sleep loss into something that's a little bit more chronic.
We're speaking with Dr. Eric Prather. He is an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at University of California, San Francisco, talking about sleep. And Eric, I have to say, just last night, I mean, granted, it's getting dark earlier and all of that, and I'm getting older, but you know, the big joke around as you age, people know you're aging because you just want to go to sleep at 8:30 or whatever. But last night I did say to my husband at 6:30, like, wow, I'm really tired. Can we go to bed yet? And this is one of the things that you say in your book, is that if you are that person, you need to try to stay up later. Why is that?
There's so many interesting things in that and what you said. So, right. So as the sun's going down earlier, that like is, you know, affecting our circadian system, which does help us kind of get sleepier earlier. Also, as we age, in some individuals, they actually experience what's called an advanced sleep phase, where they have this preference to go to bed earlier and then they end up wanting to get up earlier. But in the context of insomnia, it's often the case that people are so concerned about their sleep. They're kind of chasing it. And it's so unpredictable that they get in bed really early because they don't know when sleep's going to happen, right? They're like, I need to be there because it might happen. I'm worried that it won't. And so they end up spending like an incredibly large amount of time in bed, despite the fact that as a human, they can't make the amount of sleep that they're kind of planning for, right? Like they're getting in bed at 7, they want to get up at 7, but they can only make 8 hours of sleep. And so, you know, as a consequence, they're guaranteeing 4 hours of wakefulness in that process. And so the staying up later is really to try to affect that, right? To kind of limit that. And so what we have people do in this book and in our clinic is keep a sleep diary over the course of a week. And that will tell us kind of how much sleep someone's really getting. And then we try to kind of set up a sleep schedule that matches that so that people aren't spending excess time in bed not sleeping. And the way that we usually do that is by moving their bedtimes later. And so when we do that, people have an easier time falling asleep, and then their sleep becomes more consolidated.
Yep. Okay, I have to ask you, we talked about sleep aids already, but I want to circle back because the more we find out about the miraculous cannabis plant, the more we want to talk about it. And I find that, you know, eating a half of a little gummy, of course, only in states where it's legal, that is a mixture of CBD and THC, is just magical for a night's sleep. But again, does it become something that over the course of time isn't going to work as well, and therefore we shouldn't pursue something like that? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, I'm going to fall back on like, well, we just don't have the evidence. I mean, this has been one of the challenges in the sleep science, because I mean, certainly THC, CBD, you know, it works for a lot of people. It's probably the most common question that we get in our clinic, but you know, we haven't done the clinical trials to understand kind of what's placebo, what is, you know, the real effect of that substance. And then it also is in line with the idea that, well, it does create a dependency, like even if it's a psychological one. And is that something that you want to take on long term? You know, and then as you mentioned, you know, maybe there is some tolerance that builds up over time for some individuals. And so then that's something where you have to kind of increase the dose or change the strain or try, you know, all these other things that where kind of my stance is like, look, maybe we can figure out a way that you can sleep well without those things. And let's kind of work on that. And maybe, you know, you use the half a gummy or what have you in acute situations where you really want that kind of special sleep that you get when you consume that, and then you don't have to worry about it not working over time.
What about the use of like a cannabis versus commonly known prescription of like Ambien, and how have, so I you know, because the Ambien's an FDA regulated drug, there's obviously a lot more studies and cases on it, but is cannabis behind on that because of the federal regulations, or it's just so young, and how does it compare, if at all, to these types of drugs? Because I've taken Ambien before, and I mean, I've legitimately hallucinated on it. So it seems like a kind of a scary alternative to sleep.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, you're totally right, David. It, you know, that there are, you know, certainly side effects to taking Ambien. And it's really important to kind of, if you're going to take that drug, to kind of take it in a safe environment the first time to see, you know, how your body responds. And, you know, you're also right that, you know, the research on cannabis in kind of a rigorous setting is absolutely behind. And it's driven largely by the fact that most of the research that I do and others do around the country is funded by the federal government. And so it's not something that we can test. It's not something that we can get, say, a formulation that then once we test it, someone can go out in the world and buy it, right? So companies will make kind of special THC, CBD formulations that, you know, you potentially can test. I know for a fact that it's actually really hard to get this research off the ground. We've tried, and there's lots of barriers to doing this. But I do think it's an important avenue forward. And, you know, I think in the next couple years, you know, as we see a sea change, I mean, it's election day, you know, today, who knows how many places around the country are trying to legalize these things. And so I think it's a matter of when, not if, we'll have these data. And it'll just be another tool that people can have. Again, I'm not a proponent for taking these types of things. But, you know, I think it's important to have alternatives, particularly ones that might be more natural than kind of the pharmaceuticals that are available today.
So the book is The Sleep Prescription, 7 Days to Unlocking Your Best Rest. Our guest is Dr. Eric Prather. Eric, this is a great book. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me.
And stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.